Perhaps Marjorie did not believe her. Joff always played the perfect knight with her, as once he had with Sansa. She will see his true nature soon enough, after the wedding, if not before. Sansa decided that she would light a candle to the Mother Above the next time she visited the Sept, and ask her to protect Marjorie from Joffrey's cruelty, and perhaps a candle to the warrior as well, for Loras. She would wear her new gown for the ceremony at the Great Sept of Baelor, she decided, as the seamstress took her last measurement. That must be why Cersei is having it made for me, so I will not look shabby at the wedding. She really ought to have a different gown for the feast afterward, but she supposed one of her old ones would do. She did not want to risk getting food or wine on the new one. I must take it with me to Highgarden. She wanted to look beautiful for Willis Tyrell, even if Dontus was right. And it is Winterfell he wants, and not me. He still may come to love me for myself. Sansa hugged herself tightly, wondering how long it would be before the gown was ready. She could scarcely wait to wear it. Arya. The rains came and went, but there was more grey sky than blue, and all the streams were running high. On the morning of the third day, Arya noticed that the moss was growing mostly on the wrong side of the trees. "We're going the wrong way," she said to Gendry, as they rode past an especially mossy elm. "We're going south. See how the moss is growing on the trunk?" He pushed thick black hair from his eyes and said, "We're following the road, that's all. The road goes south here." "We've been going south all day," she wanted to tell him, "and yesterday too, when we were riding along that stream bed." But she hadn't been paying close attention yesterday, so she couldn't be certain. "I think we're lost," she said in a low voice. "We shouldn't have left the river. All we had to do was follow it." "The river bends and loops," said Gendry. "This is just a shorter way, I bet. Some secret outlaw way. Lem and Tom and them have been living here for years." That was true. Arya bit her lip. "But the moss. The way it's raining, we'll have moss growing from our ears before long," Gendry complained. "Only from our south ear," Arya declared stubbornly. There was no use trying to convince the bull of anything. Still, he was the only true friend she had, now that Hot Pie had left them.
"Shauna says she needs me to bake bread," he told her the day they rode. "Anyhow, I'm tired of rain and saddle sores and being scared all the time. There's ale here and rabbit teat, and the bread will be better when I make it. You'll see when you come back. You will come back, won't you, when the war's done?"
He remembered who she was then and added, "My lady," reddening. Arya didn't know if the war would ever be done, but she had nodded. "I'm sorry I beat you that time," she said. Hot Pie was stupid and craven, but he'd been with her all the way from King's Landing, and she'd gotten used to him. "I broke your nose."
"You broke Lem's too," Hot Pie grinned. "That was good."
"Lem didn't think so," Arya said glumly. Then it was time to go. When Hot Pie asked if he might kiss Milady's hand, she punched his shoulder.
"Don't call me that. You're Hot Pie, and I'm Harry." "I'm not Hot Pie here. Shauna just calls me Boy, the same as she calls the other Boy. It's going to be confusing."
She missed him more than she thought she would, but Harwin made up for it some. She had told him about his father, Hullan, and how she'd found him dying by the stables in the Red Keep the day she fled. "He always said he'd die in a stable," Harwin said. "But we all thought some bad-tempered stallion would be his death, not a pack of lions." Arya told of Yoren and their escape from King's Landing as well, and much that had happened since. But she left out the stable boy she'd stabbed with needle, and the guard whose throat she'd cut to get out of Harrenhal. Telling Harwin would be almost like telling her father, and there were some things she could not bear having her father know. Nor did she speak of Jake and Hagar, and the three deaths he'd owed and paid. The iron coin he'd given her, Arya kept tucked away beneath her belt, but sometimes at night she would take it out and remember how his face had melted and changed when he ran his hand across it. "Velar Morghulis," she would say under her breath. "Sir Gregor, Dunson, Polliver, Raff the Sweetling, the Tickler and the Hound, Sir Ilion, Sir Merin, Queen Cersei, King Joffrey." Only 6 Winterfell men remained of the 20 her father had sent west with Beric Dondarrion, Harwin told her, and they were scattered. "It was a trap, milady. Lord Tywin sent his mountain across the Red Fork with fire and sword, hoping to draw your lord father. He planned for Lord Eddard to come west himself to deal with Gregor Clegane. If he had, he would have been killed or taken prisoner and traded for the imp, who was your mother's captive at the time. Only the Kingslayer never knew Lord Tywin's plan, and when he heard about his brother's capture, he attacked your father in the streets of King's Landing." "I remember," said Arya, "he killed Jorri." Jorri had always smiled at her when he wasn't telling her to get from underfoot. "He killed Jorri," Harwin agreed, "and your father's leg was broken when his horse fell on him. So Lord Eddard couldn't go west. He sent Lord Beric instead with 20 of his own men and 20 from Winterfell, me among them. There were others besides, Thoros and Sir Raymond Darry and their men, Sir Gladden Wild, a lord named Lothar Mallory. But Gregor was waiting for us at the Mummer's Ford with men concealed on both banks. As we crossed, he fell upon us from front and rear. I saw the mountain slay Raymond Darry with a single blow. So terrible, it took Darry's arm off at the elbow and killed the horse beneath him, too. Gladden Wild died there with him, and Lord Mallory was ridden down and drowned. We had lions on every side, and I thought I was doomed with the rest. But Allen shouted commands and restored order to our ranks, and those still a horse rallied around Thoros and cut our way free. 60 we'd been that morning. By dark, no more than 20 were left, and Lord Beric was gravely wounded. Thoros drew a foot of lance from his chest that night and poured boiling wine into the hole it left. Every man of us was certain his lordship would be dead by daybreak, but Thoros prayed with him all night beside the fire, and when dawn came he was still alive and stronger than he had been. It was a fortnight before he could mount a horse, but his courage kept us strong. He told us that our war had not ended at the Mummer's Ford, but only begun there, and that every man of ours who'd fallen would be avenged tenfold. By then the fighting had passed by us. The mountain's men were only the van of Lord Tywin's host. They crossed the Red Fork in strength and swept up into the riverlands, burning everything in their path. We were so few that all we could do was harry their rear. But we told each other that we'd join up with King Robert when he marched west to crush Lord Tywin's rebellion. Only then we heard that Robert was dead, and Lord Eddard as well, and Cersei Lannister's whelp had ascended the Iron Throne. That turned the whole world on its head. We'd been sent out by the King's Hand to deal with outlaws, you see, but now we were the outlaws, and Lord Tywin was the Hand of the King. There were some wanted to yield then, but Lord Beric wouldn't hear of it. We were still King's men, he said, and these were the King's people the lions were savaging. If we could not fight for Robert, we would fight for them, until every man of us was dead. And so we did. But as we fought, something queer happened. For every man we lost, 2 showed up to take his place. A few were knights or squires of gentle birth, but most were common men, field hands and fiddlers and innkeepers, servants and shoemakers, even 2 septons, men of all sorts, and women too, children, dogs.
Dogs? Said Arya.
Aye, Harwin grinned. One of our lads keeps the meanest dogs you'd ever want to see. "I wish I had a good mean dog," said Arya wistfully. "A lion-killing dog." She'd had a dire wolf once, Nymeria, but she'd thrown rocks at her until she fled, to keep the queen from killing her. Could a dire wolf kill a lion? She wondered. It rained again that afternoon, and long into the evening. Thankfully, the outlaws had secret friends all over, so they did not need to camp out in the open or seek shelter beneath some leaky bower, as she and Hutpie and Gendry had done so often. That night, they sheltered in a burned, abandoned village. At least it seemed to be abandoned, until Jack Bilucky blew two short blasts and two long ones on his hunting horn. Then all sorts of people came crawling out of the ruins and up from secret cellars. They had ale and dried apples and some stale barley bread, and the outlaws had a goose that Angai had brought down on the ride. So supper that night was almost a feast. Arya was sucking the last bit of meat off a wing when one of the villagers turned to Lem Lemoncloak and said,
"There were men through here, not 2 days past, looking for the Kingslayer."
Lem snorted.
"They do better looking in Riverrun, down in the deepest dungeons, where it's nice and damp."
His nose looked like a squashed apple, red and raw and swollen, and his mood was foul.
"No," another villager said, "he's escaped." The Kingslayer.
Arya could feel the hair on the back of her neck prickling. She held her breath to listen.
"Could that be true?" Tom-O-Seven said. "I'll not believe it," said the one-eyed man in the rusty pothelm.
The other outlaws called him Jack Bilucky, though losing an eye didn't seem very lucky to Arya.
"I've had me taste of them dungeons. How could he escape?"
The villagers could only shrug at that. Greenbeard stroked his thick grey and green whiskers and said,
"The wolves will drown in blood if the Kingslayer's loose again. Thoros must be told. The Lord of Late will show him Lannister in the flames."
"There's a fine fire burning here," said Angai, smiling. Greenbeard laughed and cuffed the archer's ear.
"Do I look like a priest to you, archer? When Pelo of Tyrosh peers into the fire, the cinders singe his beard."
Lem cracked his knuckles and said,
"Wouldn't Lord Beric love to capture Jaime Lannister, though?" "Would he hang him then, Lem?"
one of the village women asked.
"It'll be half a shame to hang a man as pretty as that one."
"A trial first," said Angai. "Lord Beric always gives them a trial, you know that." He smiled. "Then he hangs them." There was laughter all around. Then Tom drew his fingers across the strings of his woodharp and broke into soft song.
"The brothers of the Kingswood, they were an outlaw band. The forest was their castle, but they roamed across the land. No man's gold was safe from them, nor any maiden's hand. Oh, the brothers of the Kingswood, that fearsome outlaw band."
Warm and dry in a corner between Gendry and Harwin, Arya listened to the singing for a time, then closed her eyes and drifted off to sleep. She dreamt of home, not Riverrun, but Winterfell. It was not a good dream, though. She was alone outside the castle, up to her knees in mud. She could see the grey walls ahead of her, but when she tried to reach the gates, every step seemed harder than the one before, and the castle faded before her, until it looked more like smoke than granite. And there were wolves as well, gaunt, grey shapes stalking through the trees all around her, their eyes shining. Whenever she looked at them, she remembered the taste of blood. The next morning, they left the road to cut across the fields. The wind was gusting, sending dry brown leaves swirling around the hooves of their horses, but for once it did not rain. When the sun came out from behind a cloud, it was so bright Arya had to pull her hood forward to keep it out of her eyes. She reined up very suddenly.
"We are going the wrong way."
Gendry groaned.
"What is it, moss again?"
"Look at the sun," she said. "We're going south." Arya rummaged in her saddlebag for the map, so she could show them. We should never have left the Triton, see? She unrolled the map on her leg. All of them were looking at her now. See, there's Riverrun between the rivers.
As it happens, said Jack Belocchi, we know where Riverrun is, every man of us.
You're not going to Riverrun,
Lem told her bluntly.
I was almost there, Arya thought. I should have let them take our horses. I could have walked the rest of the way.
She remembered her dream then and bit her lip.
Don't look so hurt, child, said Tom Sevenstrings. No harm will come to you. You have my word on that.
The word of a liar?
No one lied, said Lem. We made no promises. It's not for us to say what's to be done with you.
Lem was not the leader, though, no more than Tom. That was Greenbeard, the Tyroshi. Arya turned to face him. Take me to Riverrun, and you'll be rewarded, she said desperately.
A little one, Greenbeard answered. A peasant may skin a common squirrel for his pot, but if he finds a gold squirrel in his tree, he takes it to his lord, or he will wish he did.
I'm not a squirrel, Arya insisted.
Yeah, Greenbeard laughed. A little gold squirrel who's off to see the Lightning Lord, whether she wills it or not. He'll know what's to be done with you. I'll wager he'll send you back to your lady mother just as you wish.
Tom Sevenstrings nodded.
Aye, that's like Lord Beric. He'll do right by you. See if he don't.
Lord Beric Dondarrion. Arya remembered all she had heard at Harrenhal from the Lannisters and the Bloody Mamas alike. Lord Beric, the Wisp of the Wood, Lord Beric, who'd been killed by Varga Hote, and before that by Sir Aemery Lorch, and twice by the Mountain That Rides. If he won't send me home, maybe I'll kill him too. Why do I have to see Lord Beric? She asked quietly.
We bring him all our high-born captives, said Angai.
Captive? Arya took a breath to still her soul. Calm as still water. She glanced at the outlaws on their horses and turned her horse's head.
Now, quick as a snake, she thought, as she slammed her heels into the courser's flank.
Right between Greenbeard and Jack Belocchi she flew and caught one glimpse of Gendry's startled face as his mount moved out of her way. And then she was in the open field and running. North or south, east or west, that made no matter now. She could find the way to Riverrun later, once she'd lost them. Arya leaned forward in the saddle and urged the horse to a gallop. Behind her, the outlaws were cursing and shouting at her to come back. She shut her ears to the calls, but when she glanced back over her shoulder, four of them were coming after her. Angai and Harwin and Greenbeard racing side by side, with Lem farther back, his big yellow cloak flapping behind him as he rode.
Swift as a deer, she told her mount. Run now, run!
Arya dashed across brown, weedy fields, through waist-high grass and piles of dry leaves that flurried and flew when her horse galloped past. There were woods to her left, she saw. I can lose them there. A dry ditch ran along one side of the field, but she leapt it without breaking stride and plunged in among the stand of elm and yew and birch trees. A quick peek back showed Angai and Harwin still hard on her heels. Greenbeard had fallen behind, though, and she could not see Lem at all.
Faster, she told her horse. You can, you can.
Between two elms she rode and never paused to see which side the moss was growing on. She leapt a rotten log and swung wide around a monstrous deadfall, jagged with broken branches. Then up a gentle slope and down the other side, slowing and speeding up again, her horse's shoes striking sparks off the flintstones underfoot. At the top of the hill she glanced back. Harwin had pushed ahead of Angai, but both were coming hard. Greenbeard had fallen further back and seemed to be flagging. A stream barred her way. She splashed down into it, through water choked with wet brown leaves. Some clung to a horse's legs as they climbed the other side. The undergrowth was thicker here, the ground so full of roots and rocks that she had to slow. But she kept as good a pace as she dared. Another hill before her, this one steeper. Up she went, and down again. How big are these woods, she wondered. She had the faster horse, she knew that. She had stolen one of Bruce Bolton's best from the stables at Harrenhal, but his speed was wasted here. I need to find the fields again. I need to find a road. Instead, she found a game trail. It was narrow and uneven, but it was something. She raced along it, branches whipping at her face. One snagged her hood and yanked it back, and for half a heartbeat she feared they had caught her. A vixen burst from the brush as she passed, startled by the fury of her flight. The game trail brought her to another stream. Or was it the same one? Had she gotten turned around? There was no time to puzzle it out. She could hear the horses crashing through the trees behind her. Thorns scratched at her face like the cats she used to chase in King's Landing. Sparrows exploded from the branches of an alder, but the trees were thinning now, and suddenly she was out of them. Broad, level fields stretched before her, all weeds and wild wheat, sudden and trampled. Arya kicked her horse back to a gallop. "Run!" she thought. "Run for River Run! Run for home!" Had she lost them? She took one quick look, and there was Harwin, 6 yards back and gaining. "No," she thought. "No, he can't. Not him. It isn't fair." Both horses were lathered and flagging by the time he came up beside her, reached over, and grabbed her bridle. Arya was breathing hard herself then. She knew the fight was done. "You ride like a Northman, milady," Harwin said when he'd drawn them to a halt. "Your aunt was the same, Lady Lyanna. But my father was master of horse, remember?" The look she gave him was full of hurt. "I thought you were my father's man." "Lord Eddard's dead, milady. I belong to the Lightning Lord now, and to my brothers." "What brothers?" Old Holland had fathered no other sons that Arya could remember. "Anguy, Lem, Thomas Evans, Jack, and Greenbeard, all of them. We mean your brother Rob no ill, milady, but it's not him we fight for. He has an army all his own, and many a great lord to bend the knee. The small folk have only us." He gave her a searching look. "Can you understand what I'm telling you?" Yes, that he was not Rob's man, she understood well enough, and that she was his captive. "I could have stayed with Hot Pie. We could have taken the little boat and sailed it up to River Run." She had been better off as Squab. No one would take Squab captive, or Nan, or Weasel, or Arry, the orphan boy. "I was a wolf," she thought. "But now I'm just some stupid little lady again." "Will you ride back peaceful now?" Harwin asked her. "Or must I tie you up and throw you across your horse?" "All right, peaceful," she said sullenly. "For now."
Bran. It seemed as though he had been falling for years. "Fly," a voice whispered in the darkness, but Bran did not know how to fly, so all he could do was fall. Maester Lewin made a little boy of clay, baked him until he was hard and brittle, dressed him in Bran's clothes, and flung him off a roof. Bran remembered the way he shattered. "But I never fall," he said, falling. The ground was so far below him he could barely make it out through the grey mist that whirled around him, but he could feel how fast he was falling, and he knew what was waiting for him down there. Even in dreams you could not fall forever. He would wake up in the instant before he hit the ground, he knew. You always wake up in the instant before you hit the ground.
"And if you don't?" the voice asked.
The ground was closer now. Still far, far away, 1,000 miles away, but closer than it had been. It was cold here in the darkness. There was no sun, no stars, only the ground below, coming up to smash him, and the grey mists and the whispering voice. He wanted to cry.
"Not cry, fly."
"I can't fly," Bran said. "I can't, I can't."
"How do you know? Have you ever tried?"
The voice was high and thin. Bran looked around to see where it was coming from. A crow was spiralling down with him, just out of reach, following him as he fell. "Help me," he said.
"I'm trying," the crow replied. Say, got any corn?
Bran reached into his pocket as the darkness spun dizzily around him. When he pulled his hand out, golden kernels slid from between his fingers into the air. They fell with him. The crow landed on his hand and began to eat. Are you really a crow? Bran asked.
Are you really fallen?
The crow asked back.
It's just a dream, Bran said. Is it? Asked the crow.
I'll wake up when I hit the ground, Bran told the bird.
You'll die when you hit the ground, the crow said.
It went back to eating corn. Bran looked down. He could see mountains now, their peaks white with snow, and the silver thread of rivers in dark woods. He closed his eyes and began to cry.
That won't do any good, the crow said. I told you. The answer is flying, not crying. How hard can it be? I'm doing it.
The crow took to the air and flapped around Bran's hand. You have wings, Bran pointed out.
Maybe you do, too.
Bran felt along his shoulders, groping for feathers.
There are different kinds of wings, the crow said.
Bran was staring at his arms, his legs. He was so skinny, just skin stretched taut over bones. Had he always been so thin? He tried to remember. A face swam up to him out of the grey mist, shining with light, golden. The things I do for love, it said. Bran screamed. The crow took to the air, cawing.
Not that, it shrieked at him. Forget that. You do not need it now. Put it aside. Put it away.
It landed on Bran's shoulder and pecked at him, and the shining gold face was gone. Bran was falling faster than ever. The grey mist howled around him as he plunged towards the earth below. What are you doing to me? He asked the crow tearfully.
Teaching you how to fly.
I can't fly.
You're flying right now.
I'm falling.
Every flight begins with a fall, the crow said. Look down.
I'm afraid.
Look down.
Bran looked down and felt his insides turn to water. The ground was rushing up at him now. The whole world was spread out below him, a tapestry of white and brown and green. He could see everything so clearly that for a moment he forgot to be afraid. He could see the whole realm and everyone in it. He saw Winterfell as the eagles see it, the tall towers looking squat and stubby from above, the castle walls just lines in the dirt. He saw Maester Luin on his balcony, studying the sky through a polished bronze tube and frowning as he made notes in a book. He saw his brother Rob, taller and stronger than he remembered him, practicing swordplay in the yard with real steel in his hand. He saw Hodor, the simple giant from the stables, carrying an anvil to Mickon's forge, hefting it onto his shoulder as easily as another man might heft a bale of hay. At the heart of the Godswood, the great white weirwood brooded over its reflection in the black pool, its leaves rustling in a chill wind. When it felt Bran watching, it lifted its eyes from the still waters and stared back at him knowingly. He looked east. He saw a galley racing across the waters of the Bight. He saw his mother sitting alone in a cabin, looking at a blood-stained knife on a table in front of her, as the rowers pulled at their oars, and Sir Roderick leaned across a rail, shaking and heaving. A storm was gathering ahead of them, a vast dark roaring, lashed by lightning, but somehow they could not see it. He looked south, and saw the great blue-green rush of the Trident. He saw his father pleading with the king, his face etched with grief. He saw Sansa crying herself to sleep at nights, and he saw Arya watching in silence, and holding her secrets hard in her heart. There were shadows all around them. One shadow was dark as ash, with a terrible face of a hound. Another was armored like the sun, golden and beautiful. Over them both loomed a giant in armor made of stone. But when he opened his visor, there was nothing inside but darkness and thick black blood. He lifted his eyes and saw clear across the narrow sea, to the free cities and the green Dothraki sea and beyond, to Vaes Dothrak under its mountain, to the fabled lands of the Jade Sea, to a Shai by the shadow, where dragons stirred beneath the sunrise. Finally, he looked north. He saw the wall, shining like blue crystal, and his bastard brother John sleeping alone in a cold bed, his skin growing pale and hard as a memory of all warmth fled from him. And he looked past the wall, past endless forests cloaked in snow, past the frozen shore and the great blue-white rivers of ice and the dead plains where nothing grew or lived. North and north and north he looked, to the curtain of light at the end of the world, and then beyond that curtain. He looked deep into the heart of winter, and then he cried out, afraid, and the heat of his tears burned on his cheeks.
"Now you know," the crow whispered, as it sat on his shoulder. "Now you know why you must live."
"Why?" Bran said, not understanding, falling.
"Because winter is coming."
Bran looked at the crow on his shoulder, and the crow looked back. It had three eyes, and the third eye was full of a terrible knowledge. Bran looked down. There was nothing below him now but snow and cold and death. A frozen wasteland where jagged blue-white spires of ice waited to embrace him. They flew up at him like spears. He saw the bones of 1,000 other dreamers impaled upon their points. He was desperately afraid. "Can a man still be brave if he's afraid?" he heard his own voice saying, small and far away. And his father's voice replied to him, "That's the only time a man can be brave."
"How, Bran?" the crow urged. "Choose, fly or die."
Death reached for him, screaming. Bran spread his arms and flew. Wings unseen drank the wind and filled and pulled him upward. The terrible needles of ice receded below him. The sky opened up above. Bran soared. It was better than climbing. It was better than anything. The world grew small beneath him. "I'm flying!" he cried out in delight.
"I've noticed," said the three-eyed crow.
It took to the air, flapping its wings in his face, slowing him, blinding him. He faltered in the air as its pinions beat against his cheeks. Its beak stabbed at him fiercely, and Bran felt a sudden blinding pain in the middle of his forehead, between his eyes. "What are you doing?" he shrieked. The crow opened his beak and cawed at him, a shrill scream of fear, and the grey mist shuddered and swirled around him and ripped away like a veil, and he saw that the crow was really a woman, a serving woman, with long black hair, and he remembered her from somewhere, from Winterfell. Yes, that was it. He remembered her now, and then he realized that he was in Winterfell, in a bed high in some chilly tower room, and the black-haired woman dropped a basin of water to shatter on the floor and ran down the steps shouting, "He's awake! He's awake! He's awake!" Bran touched his forehead between his eyes. The place where the crow had pecked him was still burning, but there was nothing there, no blood, no wound. He felt weak and dizzy. He tried to get out of bed, but nothing happened. And then there was movement beside the bed, and something landed lightly on his legs. He felt nothing. A pair of yellow eyes looked into his own, shining like the sun. The window was open, and it was cold in the room, but the warmth that came off the wolf enfolded him like a hot bath. His pup, Bran realized. Or was it? He was so big now. He reached out to pet him, his hand trembling like a leaf. When his brother Rob burst into the room, breathless from his dash up the tower steps, the direwolf was licking Bran's face. Bran looked up calmly.
"His name is Summer," he said. Circe. Three wretched fools with a leather sack, the queen thought, as they sank to their knees before her. The look of them did not encourage her. I suppose there is always a chance. Your Grace, said Caiban quietly, the small council, will await my pleasure. It may be that we can bring them word of a traitor's death. Off across the city, the bells of Bela's sept rang their song of mourning. No bells will ring for you, Tyrion, Circe thought. I shall dip your head in tar and give your twisted body to the dogs. Off your knees, she told the would-be lords. Show me what you've brought me. They rose, three ugly men and ragged. One had a boil on his neck, and none had washed in half a year. The prospect of raising such to lordship amused her. I could seat them next to Margaery at feasts. When the chief fool undid the drawstring on the sack and plunged his hand inside, the smell of decay filled her audience chamber like some rank rose. The head he pulled out was grey-green and crawling with maggots. It smells like father. Dorcas gasped, and Jocelyn covered her mouth and retched. The queen considered her prize unflinching. "You've killed the wrong dwarf," she said at last, grudging every word. "We never did," one of the fools dared to say. "This has got to be him, sir. A dwarf, see? He's rotted some, is all." "He has also grown a new nose," Circe observed. "A rather bulbous one, I'd say. Tyrion's nose was hacked off in a battle." The three fools exchanged a look. "No one told us," said the one with head in hand. "This one come walking along as bold as you please, some ugly dwarf, so we thought." "He said he were a sparrow," the one with the boil added, "and you said he was lying." That was directed at the third man. The queen was angry to think that she had kept her small council waiting for this mummer's farce. "You have wasted my time and slain an innocent man. I should have your own heads off." But if she did, the next man might hesitate and let the imp slip the net. She would pile dead dwarfs 10 feet high before she let that happen. "Remove yourselves from my sight." "Aye, Your Grace," said the boil. "We beg your pardons." "Do you want the head?" asked the man who held it. "Give it to Sir Merrin." "No, in the sack, you lackwit." "Yes, Sir Osmond, see them out." Trant removed the head and Kettleblack the headsman, leaving only Lady Jocelyn's breakfast as evidence of their visit. "Clean that up at once," the queen commanded her. This was the third head that had been delivered to her. At least this one was a dwarf. The last had simply been an ugly child. "Someone will find the dwarf, never fear," Sir Osmond assured her, "and when they do, we'll kill him good." "Will you?" Last night Circe had dreamed of the old woman with her pebbly jowls and croaking voice. Maggie the Frog, they had called her in Lannisport. If father had known what she said to me, he would have had her tongue out. Circe had never told anyone, though, not even Jamie. Malara said that if we never spoke about her prophecies, we would forget them. She said that a forgotten prophecy couldn't come true. "I have informers sniffing after the imp everywhere, Your Grace," said Caiban. He had garbed himself in something very like maester's robes, but white instead of grey, immaculate as the cloaks of the king's guard. Walls of gold decorated his hem, sleeves, and stiff high collar, and a golden sash was tied about his waist. Old Town, Galtown, Dawn, even the free cities, wheresoever he might run, my whisperers will find him. You assume he left King's Landing. He could be hiding in Baelor's Sept, for all we know, swinging on the bell ropes to make that awful din. Circe made a sour face and let Dorcas help her to her feet. Come, my lord, my counsel awaits. She took Caiban by the arm as they made their way down the stairs. Have you attended to that little task I set you? I have, Your Grace. I am sorry that it took so long. Such a large head. It took the beetles many hours to clean the flesh. By way of pardon, I have lined a box of ebony and silver with felt to make a fitting presentation for the skull. A cloth sack would serve as well. Prince Doran wants his head. He won't give a fig what sort of box it comes in. The pealing of the bells was louder in the yard. He was only a high septon. How long must we endure this? The ringing was more melodious than the mountain's screams had been, but Kyburn seemed to sense what she was thinking. The bells will stop at sunset, Your Grace. That will be a great relief. How can you know? Knowing is the nature of my service. Varys had all of us believing he was irreplaceable. What fools we were. Once the Queen let it become known that Kyburn had taken the eunuch's place, the usual vermin had wasted no time in making themselves known to him, to trade their whispers for few coins. It was the silver all along, not the spider. Kyburn will serve us just as well. She was looking forward to the look on Pycelle's face when Kyburn took his seat. A knight of the King's Guard was always posted outside the doors of the council chambers when the small council was in session. Today it was Sir Boros Blount. "Sir Boros," the Queen said pleasantly, "you look quite grey this morning. Something you ate, perchance?" Jamie had made him the King's food taster. A tasty task, but shameful for a knight. Blount hated it. His sagging jowls quivered as he held the door for them. The councillors quieted as she entered. Lord Giles coughed by way of greeting, loud enough to wake Pycelle. The others rose, mouthing pleasantries. Circe allowed herself the faintest of smiles. "My lords, I know you will forgive my lateness." "We are here to serve your grace," said Sir Harry's Swift. "It is our pleasure to anticipate your coming." "You all know Lord Kyburn, I am sure." Grand Maester Pycelle did not disappoint her. "Lord Kyburn," he managed, purpling, "Your Grace, this a maester swears sacred vows to hold no lands or lordships." "Your citadel took away his chain," Circe reminded him. "If he is not a maester, he cannot be held to a maester's vows. We called the eunuch Lord as well, you may recall." Pycelle sputtered. "This man is... he is unfit." "Do not presume to speak to me of fitness, not after the stinking mockery you made of my lord father's corpse." "Your Grace cannot think..." He raised a spotted hand as if to ward off a blow. "The silent sisters removed Lord Tywin's bowels and organs, drained his blood. Every care was taken. His body was stuffed with salts and fragrant herbs." "Oh, spare me the disgusting details. I smelled the results of your care. Lord Kyburn's healing art saved my brother's life, and I do not doubt that he will serve the king more ably than that simpering eunuch. My lord, you know your fellow councillors." "I would be a poor informer if I did not, Your Grace." Kyburn seated himself between Orton Merryweather and Giles Rosby. "My counsellors." Circe had uprooted every rose and all those beholden to her uncle and her brothers. In their places were men whose loyalty would be to her. She had even given them new styles, borrowed from the free cities. The Queen would have no masters at court beside herself. Orton Merryweather was her justiciar, Giles Rosby her Lord Treasurer. Aurain Waters, the dashing young bastard of Driftmark, would be her grand admiral, and for her hand, Sir Harry's Swift. Soft, bald, and obsequious, Swift had an absurd little white puff of beard where most men had a chin. The blue bantam rooster of his house was worked across the front of his plush yellow doublet in beads of lapis. Over that he wore a mantle of blue velvet decorated with 100 golden hands. Sir Harry's had been thrilled by his appointment, too dim to realize that he was more hostage than hand. His daughter was her uncle's wife, and Kevin loved his chinless lady, flat-chested and chicken-legged as she was. So long as she had Sir Harry's in hand, Kevin Lannister must needs think twice about opposing her. To be sure, a good father is not the ideal hostage, but better a flimsy shield than none. "Will the king be joining us?" asked Orton Merryweather. "My son is playing with his little queen. For the moment, his idea of kingship is stamping papers with the royal seal. His grace is still too young to comprehend affairs of state. And our valiant Lord Commander. Sir Jamie is at his armourer's being fitted for a hand. I know we were all tired of that ugly stump, and I dare say he would find these proceedings as tiresome as Tommen." Aurane Waters chuckled at that. "Good," Circe thought. "The more they laugh, the less he is a threat. Let them laugh. Do we have wine?"
"We do, Your Grace."
Orton Merryweather was not a comely man with his big lumpish nose and shock of unruly reddish-orange hair, but he was never less than courteous. "We have Dornish Red and Arbor Gold, and a fine sweet Hippocras from Highgarden." "The gold, I think. I find Dornish wines as sour as the Dornish." As Merryweather filled her cup, Circe said, "I suppose we had as well begin with them." Grand Maester Pycelle's lips were still quivering, yet somehow he found his tongue. "As you command. Prince Doran has taken his brother's unruly bastards into custody, yet Sunspear still seethes. The prince writes that he cannot hope to calm the waters until he receives the justice that was promised him." "To be sure, a tiresome creature, this prince. His long wait is almost done. I am sending Balon Swan to Sunspear to deliver him the head of Gregor Clegane." Sir Balon would have another task as well, but that part was best left unsaid. "Ah!" Sir Harry Swift fumbled at his funny little beard with thumb and forefinger. "He is dead, then, Sir Gregor."
"I would think so, my lord," Aurane Waters said dryly. "I am told that removing the head from the body is often mortal."
Circe favoured him with a smile. She liked a bit of wit, so long as she was not its target. "Sir Gregor perished of his wounds, just as Grand Maester Pycelle foretold." Pycelle harumphed and eyed Kyburn sourly. "The spear was poisoned. No man could have saved him." "So you said. I recall it well." The queen turned to her hand. "What were you speaking of when I arrived, Sir Harry's?"
"Sparrows, Your Grace. Septon Reynard says there may be as many as 2,000 in the city, and more arriving every day. Their leaders preach of doom and demon worship."
Circe took a taste of wine. "Very nice.
And long past time, wouldn't you agree? What would you call this red god that Stannis worships, if not a demon? The faith should oppose such evil."
Kyburn had reminded her of that, the clever man. "Our late High Septon let too much pass, I fear. Age had dimmed his sight and sapped his strength."
"He was an old, done man, Your Grace."
Kyburn smiled at Pycelle. "His passing should not have surprised us. No man can ask for more than to die peacefully in his sleep, full of years."
"No," said Circe, "but we must hope that his successor is more vigorous. My friends upon the other hill tell me that it will most like be Torbert or Reynard."
Grand Maester Pycelle cleared his throat.
"I have friends among the most devout as well, and they speak of Septon Olador."
"Do not discount this man Lucian," Kyburn said. "Last night he fated 30 of the most devout on Suckling Pig and Arbor Gold, and by day he hands out hard bread to the poor to prove his piety." Aurane Waters seemed as bored as Circe by all this prattle about Septons. Seen up close, his hair was more silvery than gold, and his eyes were grey-green, where Prince Rhaegar's had been purple. Even so, the resemblance. She wondered if Waters would shave his beard for her. Though he was 10 years her junior, he wanted her. Circe could see it in the way he looked at her. Men had been looking at her that way since her breasts began to bud. "Because I was so beautiful," they said. But Jamie was beautiful as well, and they never looked at him that way. When she was small, she would sometimes don her brother's clothing as a lark.
She was always startled by how differently men treated her when they thought that she was Jamie, even Lord Tywin himself. Pycelle and Merryweather were still quibbling about who the new High Septon was like to be. "One will serve as well as another," the Queen announced abruptly, "but whosoever dons the crystal crown must pronounce an anathema upon the imp." This last High Septon had been conspicuously silent regarding Tyrion. As for these pink sparrows, so long as they preach no treason, they are the faith's problem, not ours. Lord Orton and Sir Harry's murmured agreement. Giles Rosby's attempt to do the same dissolved into a fit of coughing. Circe turned away in distaste as he was hacking up a gob of bloody phlegm. "Maester, have you brought the letter from the Vale?"
"I have, Your Grace."
Pycelle plucked it from his pile of papers and smoothed it out. "It is a declaration, rather than a letter, signed at Runestone by Bronze Yeone Royce, Lady Wainwood, Lords Hunter, Redfort, and Belmore, and Simond Templeton, the Knight of Nine Stars. All have affixed their seals. They write..." "A deal of rubbish. My lords may read the letter if they wish. Royce and these others are massing men below the Eyrie. They mean to remove Littlefinger as Lord Protector of the Vale, forcibly, if need be. The question is, ought we allow this?"
"Does Lord Baelish seek our help?"
asked Harry Swift. "Not as yet. In truth, he seems quite unconcerned. His last letter mentions the rebels only briefly before beseeching me to ship him some old tapestries of Robert's." Sir Harry's fingered his chin beard. "And these lords of the Declaration, do they appeal to the king to take a hand?" "They do not." "Then, mayhaps we need do nothing. A war in the Vale would be most tragic," said Pycelle. "War!" Orton Merryweather laughed. "Lord Baelish is a most amusing man, but one does not fight a war with witticisms. I doubt there will be bloodshed. And does it matter who is regent for little Lord Robert, so long as the Vale remits its taxes?" "No," Circe decided. If truth be told, Littlefinger had been more use at court. He had a gift for finding gold, and never coughed. "Lord Orton has convinced me. Maester Pycelle, instruct these lords declarant that no harm must come to Peter. Elsewise, the crone is content with whatever dispositions they might make for the governance of the Vale during Robert Arryn's minority."
"Very good, Your Grace."
"Might we discuss the fleet?" asked Aurane Waters. "Fewer than a dozen of our ships survived the inferno on the Blackwater. We must needs restore our strength at sea." Merryweather nodded. "Strength at sea is most essential." "Could we make use of the Iron Men?" asked Orton Merryweather. "The enemy of our enemy? What would the Seastone Chair want of us as the price of an alliance?"
"They want the North," Grand Maester Pycelle said, "which our Queen's noble father promised to House Bolton."
"How inconvenient," said Merryweather. "Still, the North is large. The lands could be divided. It need not be a permanent arrangement. Bolton might consent, so long as we assure him that our strength will be his once Stannis is destroyed."
"Balon Greyjoy is dead, I had heard," said Sir Harry Swift.
"Do we know who rules the Isles now? Did Lord Balon have a son?"
"Theo,"
coughed Lord Giles.
"Theo."
"Theon Greyjoy was raised at Winterfell, a ward of Eddard Stark," Qyburn said. "He is not like to be a friend of ours."
"I had heard he was slain," said Merryweather.
"Was there only one son?" Sir Harry Swift tugged upon his chin beard. "Brothers. There were brothers, were there not?" "Varys would have known," Circe thought with irritation. "I do not propose to climb in bed with that sorry pack of squids. Their turn will come once we have dealt with Stannis. What we require is our own fleet." "I propose we build new Drummonds," said Aurane Waters. 10 to start with."
"Where is the coin to come from?"
asked Pycelle. Lord Giles took that as an invitation to begin coughing again. He brought up more pink spittle and dabbed it away with a square of red silk.
There is no... He managed before the coughing ate his words. No, we do not...
Sir Harry's proved swift enough at least to grasp the meaning between the coughs.
The Crown incomes have never been greater, he objected. Sir Kevin told me so himself.
Lord Giles coughed.
Expenses! Gold cloaks!
Circe had heard his objections before.
Our Lord Treasurer is trying to say that we have too many gold cloaks and too little gold.
Rosby's coughing had begun to vex her. Perhaps Garth the Gross would not have been so ill.
Though large, the Crown incomes are not large enough to keep abreast of Robert's debts. Accordingly, I have decided to defer our repayment of the sums owed the Holy Faith and the Iron Bank of Braavos until war's end.
The new High Septon would doubtless wring his holy hands, and the Braavosi would squeak and squawk at her, but what of it? The money saved will be used for the building of our new fleet.
Your Grace is prudent, said Lord Merryweather. This is a wise measure, and needed, until the war is done. I concur.
And I, said Sir Harry's.
Your Grace, Pycelle said in a quavering voice, this will cause more trouble than you know, I fear.
The Iron Bank remains on Braavos, far across the sea. They shall have their gold, Maester. A Lannister pays his debts.
The Braavosi have a saying, too.
Pycelle's jeweled chain clinked softly. The Iron Bank will have its due, they say.
The Iron Bank will have its due when I say they will. Until such time, the Iron Bank will wait respectfully.
Lord Waters, commence the building of your Drummonds.
Very good, Your Grace.
Sir Harry's shuffled through some papers.
The next matter, we have had a letter from Lord Frey putting forth some claims.
How many lands and honours does that man want? Snapped the Queen. His mother must have had three teats.
My lords may not know, said Caiban, but in the wine sinks and pot shops of this city, there are those who suggest that the Crown might have been somehow complicit in Lord Walder's crime.
The other councillors stared at him uncertainly.
Do you refer to the Red Wedding? Asked Aurane Waters.
Crime, said Sir Harry's. Pycelle cleared his throat noisily. Lord Giles coughed.
These sparrows are especially outspoken, warned Caiban.
The Red Wedding was an affront to all the laws of gods and men, they say, and those who had a hand in it are damned.
Circe was not slow to take his meaning.
Lord Walder must soon face the father's judgment. He is very old. Let the sparrow spit upon his memory. It has naught to do with us.
No, said Sir Harry's.
No, said Lord Merryweather.
No one could think so, said Pycelle.
Lord Giles coughed.
A little spittle on Lord Walder's tomb is not like to disturb the grave worms,
Caiban agreed, but it would also be useful if someone were to be punished for the Red Wedding. A few Frey heads would do much to mollify the North.
Lord Walder will never sacrifice his own, said Pycelle.
No, mused Circe, but his heirs may be less squeamish.
Lord Walder will soon do us the courtesy of dying, we can hope. What better way for the new Lord of the Crossing to rid himself of inconvenient half-brothers, disagreeable cousins, and scheming sisters than by naming them the culprits?
Whilst we await Lord Walder's death, there is another matter, said Aurane Waters.
The Golden Company has broken its contract with Myr.
Around the docks I've heard men say that Lord Stannis has hired them and is bringing them across the sea.
What would he pay them with? Asked Merryweather.
Snow? They are called Golden Company. How much gold does Stannis have?
Little enough, Circe assured him.
Lord Caiban has spoken to the crew of that Myrish galley in the bay.
They claim the Golden Company is making for Volantis. If they mean to cross to Westeros, they are marching in the wrong direction.
Perhaps they grew weary of fighting on the losing side, suggested Lord Merryweather.
There is that as well,
agreed the Queen. Only a blind man could fail to see our war is all but won. Lord Tyrell has Storm's End invested. Riverrun is besieged by the Freys, and my cousin Davin, our new Warden of the West. Lord Red